Hey there, dreamers. We're back with a special live edition of Byzantine Dreams. A few months back, we were at ETH Denver. It's the largest community-organized crypto event in the world and a homecoming of sorts for Ethereum. And this year, it was extra fun because it was the first in-person event in 2 years. In between the furry suits, fire dances, corporate raves, and a room full of puppies, we had time on stage with three big names that are kind of defining this moment in crypto and Web3. First was Nadia, founder of Pussy Riot, Emily Yang, aka People Pleaser herself, leader of the NFT-buying DAO dubbed the People's Louvre, and Zuko Wilcox O'Hearn, OG cypherpunk and creator of Zcash, the original privacy coin.
We wanted to bring you these combos because they ended up being prescient in ways even we didn't realize then. In the weeks following, Nadia launched Ukraine DAO, which spun up $20 million in aid for Ukraine in a matter of days, probably the most visible, powerful intervention of crypto into current events to date. And Zuko revealed, after a 5-year wait, that he'd secretly worked alongside Snowden when launching Zcash. Kinda crazy. One thing that struck us while listening to these conversations again is that they chart the evolution of crypto activism. From the early cypherpunks who wanted to change the world by writing code that was beyond the means of governments to change or stop, to a new generation of activists extending this same tech in ways the original cypherpunks probably couldn't have imagined. Like Emily, whose DAO donated basically all the proceeds of her Hallmark NFT to stop Asian hate. Or Nadia and the work she's doing for the LGBTQ community.
2022 is shaping up to be pretty crazy. We have a brand new Tim and Eric show at the helm of the US government, a new war, inflation, the specter, and now kind of the reality of economic collapse. And we've all just kind of taken for granted that all of our friends are getting false flagged into thinking seed oil is a bigger problem than climate change, or that inflation is in fact transitory. But it's proven also to be the year that crypto begins its permanent residence in the halls of global events. We hope these conversations help you better understand some of the wonderful brains and voices at the helms of this change. So, without further delay, here's my convo with Zuko, creator of Zcash.
Followed by chats with Emily of PleaserDAO and Nadia, founder of Pussy Riot.
Hey, what's going on, everyone? I guess we sit.
It's a fireside chat, so therefore we're allowed to sit.
And so we're going to try to get through some Q&A for about 20 minutes. Then we're going to open it up to questions from the audience for a couple minutes, as long as there's interest. So I think most
especially
of y'all...
Especially from people who've been at the open bar. They get to be first in line for questions.
Yes, exactly. They will have the best questions. So yeah, just to get us started, I think your reputation may precede you in this room, but Zuko is a real-life cypherpunk. He is probably best known as the creator of Zcash. Some people may be surprised to hear that you also created Zuko's Triangle.
Oh, yeah. Zuko's Triangle is like just an idea.
In fact,
I don't even think I invented Zuko's Triangle. I think other people thought of it, and then they like credited it to me because it was in conversation with them at the time. You know how that happens?
I do. Actually, I don't, but that's great. So I'll skip the rest of the intro. All right, so let's jump in right off the bat. We got to ask you about privacy. So
privacy, it's important.
It's important. So I'm curious if you have any thoughts on this moment in privacy and maybe like information warfare in general as we are possibly heading into another war this year.
Well, that's a great framing question. Information warfare in general, it does seem to be heating up over the last like 5 years, right? Like the internet is an increasingly hostile place. My view is that like 5 and 10 and 15 and 20 years ago, there was this narrative like people don't care about privacy. And at the time I kind of believed it. I was like, oh darn, people don't care about privacy. They're so wrong. And later I thought, wait a minute, those were all stories planted by Google and Facebook to make me think people don't care about privacy. And that's not actually true. People really do care about privacy.
Yeah, I mean, I think the stakes for privacy are also different now. Like back, I don't know, even going back to the 70s and before, I feel like privacy was a conversation around like, okay, how can we avoid 1984 style digital dystopia surveillance nightmare? It's that, and now super added to it, we have, if you're not protecting your data, you're going to be subject to pretty much nonstop behavioral modification from the private sector and also nation states.
1984 was totally prophetic and everybody should read that book, but you're right, he missed like the ubiquitous behavior modification where your devices and everything you interact with on the internet is subtly nudging you to make them more money all the time. Or to get your, like, to provoke you or influence you in some way for their political purposes. It's either money or political power or both.
Yeah, and I think probably weird things are happening now that we won't know about for like 5 or 10 years.
If ever, yeah. Yes. I do hope that history like survives and there are history books that are accurate someday. Sorry. Sorry to be negative. It's a scary time for me, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, so let's jump into, I mean, probably like the most celebrated resistance to surveillance capitalism is the cypherpunks. And so a lot of people maybe don't know this, but the cryptocurrency phenomenon has been going on over 30 years now. I think the first cryptocurrency on record was DigiCash, made by David Chaum in 1989. And if my memory serves me right, you moved to Amsterdam in the 90s to work with David.
Oh, yeah.
What was that like? And compared to, you know, where you thought we'd be in the 90s, like, how does all this today compare? Is it bigger? Is it smaller? Is it just different?
So in the 90s, the internet was new, and like the World Wide Web was new. There weren't very many web pages, and I remember there was a web page that would give you a link to a new web page every day. You're like, wow, there's another web page every day. I'm going to look at that. And the cypherpunks correctly predicted or envisioned a lot of things, including cryptography, search engines, the spread of the web, and that there would be like billions of users soon. You asked what it was like to go to work on DigiCash. So DigiCash was the first cryptocurrency in a sense, because it was like an online internet native thing, and it had privacy so that the operator of the service couldn't monitor everyone's behavior. But it didn't have decentralization. DigiCash relied on a central server. And so that's why I think it failed. And you said cypherpunks are famous or whatever for resistance.
They're very celebrated, yeah.
Celebrated, and there's two reasons for that. The big one is Bitcoin. Bitcoin was the first real important success in my view. The smaller one, which was kind of a false victory, was against the United States government trying to outlaw cryptography in the early days of the internet, which also the cypherpunks were really active in. And the outcome of that, in my view, was just people started using the internet to like buy books online, and so then all of a sudden Congress was like, oh wait, maybe we'll stop trying to ban encryption for national security purposes when it turns out encryption is good for economic purposes.
Yeah, you basically couldn't have a functional economy on the internet with no encryption.
Oh yeah, that's a really weird alternate history. You know, before the cypherpunks, it was the cryptographers. David Chaum was one of them, Ron Rivest, Adi Shamir, Ralph Merkel, Whit Diffie, these are all cryptographers who were like young scientists, mathematicians who, you know, scribble on a chalkboard every day for their living. And then they happened upon these breakthroughs in cryptography. The important one was called public key cryptography. And there's this little told story where the United States military attempted to classify that, right? They had come up, and this is like absolutely not a conspiracy theory. We know because it had happened before. About 10 years earlier, some British mathematicians had discovered public key cryptography, and the British Secret Service successfully nationalized that and kept it secret and didn't do anything with it, right? Like, nothing happened. And if the American military had succeeded at the same thing, then we just wouldn't have the internet, right? Like, the internet would have lasted until attackers started attacking it, and then it would have fallen apart. It would have just become like a centralized broadcast medium like broadcast TV or whatever. So it was these cryptographers who were basically before the cypherpunks, we're talking 1970s, who performed really courageous civil disobedience and defied threats and pressure from the National Security Agency to make public key cryptography be part of the open legacy of humanity instead of a military secret.
Or a clipper chip.
Yeah, the clipper chip was a proposal to require any device that could connect to the internet. And you can see this is like 1970s thinking. It's like, oh, phones are allowed to connect to the phone network, so we have a whole long book full of rules about what phones are allowed to have. Well, any device that can connect to the internet is going to have this thing called a clipper chip in it, which gives the FBI access to everything that device does. That was a serious proposal, and it was a cypherpunk named Matt Blaze who helped kill it by hacking it. He found a flaw in the clipper chip, and he published this result that said, you know, if Congress, if you go ahead and require this, here's a hack that any person in the world can do to disable this thing. And that was one of the reasons why Congress gave up on that whole shambles and switched to like an open economy.
Yeah, no, it's. I encourage anyone who's not familiar with this to check it out. There's actually a book called Crypto by Stephen Levy that goes through all of this. It's awesome. I think it's like, we might make it required reading on my team. But okay, I want to jump back in. So when Zcash launched in October 2016, I believe is the right month.
Yeah.
Y'all launched with, at the time, was like a pretty novel mechanism for funding open source development and just general development of the protocol. Famously, you've gotten a lot of flack, you got a lot of shit from Bitcoiners for this, but this has aged really well because what you created then is actually not very dissimilar to what we're seeing with DAO grants or things like Gitcoin Aqueduct.
Yep. And the ensuing five or 6 years, it turned out that projects, that the token holders of projects funding improvements and maintenance and support themselves is superior to depending on like some whale or mega corporation or someone, or just volunteer labor.
Yeah, yeah. Is there anything that makes you like especially excited or skeptical about the way that just like FOSS funding in crypto works generally?
It's there's so much going on, I don't even know a tenth of what's happening. So that's exciting. There's probably a lot of super great ideas. Like every few months I look at the latest thing that Gitcoin is doing and I'm like, wow, that's pretty awesome. I wish I had time to understand that. So like I like experimentation, right?
Yeah. I think we're going to see a lot more of that too. Yes, I encourage everyone to check out some of the stuff Gitcoin is doing. It is awesome. Okay, this maybe feeds into my next question. Zcash and Ethereum, very different technical visions, very different technical roadmaps, a lot of overlap with people, a lot of shared values, a lot of mutual respect. Vitalik is an advisor to Electric Coin Company.
Yeah.
A lot of Ethereum people are at Zcon. Let's talk a little bit about like what are some ways in which you'd like to see the two communities work together more. We were talking a bit about Halo. It'd be cool to maybe kick off with a story about Halo and hear more about that.
Okay, Halo is, in short, it's a new zero-knowledge proof system. But let me go back and tell the history. Zero-knowledge proofs were invented by a bunch more chalkboard scribbling mathematicians in the 1980s, and then they didn't get used for anything and for decades. And this is the same pattern that happened with public key cryptography and with lots of breakthroughs, is that it could take 20, 30 years before a scientific idea reaches real usage. And in the case of zero knowledge proofs, which were invented in the 80s, it was Zcash in 2016 that made it a real live thing that people could rely on. And that first version of Zcash, it was the first, I'm really proud of it because it was like the demonstration that zero knowledge proofs are a real life thing that actually protect people's privacy in practice, and lots of money can reside on it, like trust in it, and it doesn't get hacked. But on the other hand, that first version of the math was really sucky. You had to have a laptop. It had to have 4 gigs of RAM. It would like heat up your CPU for like 10 minutes or something to make a single transaction. That was a huge leap forward in the technology in 2016. And there's another deep flaw with that math, even in addition to all of its like performance problems, is that you had to have what's called a trusted setup, which we designed it in Zcash because Zcash is like privacy first. So we designed the architecture so that the privacy of the users is 100% protected by just cryptography, no matter what. But the monetary soundness of whether there's actually exactly 21 million Zcash depends on this trusted setup. And trusted setup means somebody has to create a big cryptographic number, and then they swear that they deleted the other half, right? They didn't keep a copy. And if someone did keep a copy, they could then counterfeit Zcash. So this was a huge, huge challenge when we were setting out to do this. And what we did is literally the most secure cryptographic ceremony ever performed, at least until that date, where we got 6 different participants who didn't know who each other were because there was like all this maximum OPSEC. We tried to do maximum OPSEC in advance, operational security in advance, to prevent any hackers from finding out what we're up to, and then have maximum transparency immediately after the fact. So we released videos and signed messages and all this stuff describing everything that had happened, except for one thing, which I'll get to. And the way it was constructed, if any one of those six participants honestly deleted their secret, then nobody, including the other five, would be able to recover that counterfeiting key. So that was like the best thing that had ever been done, I think. And it still wasn't good enough, right? Like, people are not, there are plenty of people who are the kind of like paranoid, like self-sovereign people that I like, who are unwilling to assume that at least one of these six people successfully deleted their private key, as opposed to that all six of them got together in a conspiracy to counterfeit money.
Yeah, I saw David Vorek at MIT Bitcoin Expo 2019. He had a big busted setup.
Yeah, there's been a lot of criticisms, and I really appreciate, like, you know, well-intentioned, honest, like, criticism and scrutiny. And what happened was, so we invented a subsequent generation of technology, which is what you can use today.
Yeah.
Generation one was just zero-knowledge proofs actually work in practice, but not very conveniently. And we had this trusted setup problem. Generation two is what you can install on ZekWallet on your phone right now. And it only takes like 5 seconds to generate transactions on your phone, which is another breakthrough on the part of my team, and I'm super proud of it. Oh, and I told you there was one fact that wasn't yet revealed from the original setup ceremony. There were six participants. And immediately after the ceremony, and they were all like pseudonymous and stuff, and nobody knew who they were, where they lived around the globe, and all this stuff. And immediately after the ceremony, we publicly disclosed the identities of five of them. And nobody has ever known, other than me, who the sixth participant was from the original ceremony. But now Generation 3 is coming. Generation 3 is called Halo. And the important thing about it, there's two important things about it, but one is that there's no trusted setup aspect. Just Halo is just secure based on the math, and there's no people who have any secrets that have anything to do with anything. Make sense? So it's fully trustless. And the other thing about Halo is that it's a recursive zero-knowledge proof, which means you can prove any arbitrarily sized fact about any database, like the entire history of a blockchain or of all blockchains or a multi-petabyte database or anything. It's a general-purpose zero-knowledge proof, so it's potentially going to be really useful for a lot of interesting things. So now that Halo is about to launch, which is happening in March on Zcash mainnet, and if you install ZekWallet on your phone, then you'll have it. You'll be the first in line. That's the end of trust. That's like trusted setups become a thing of the past. And at that point, we're going to reveal the identity of the sixth participant from the original trusted setup back in 2016. So stay tuned.
I thought we were doing this Kool-Aid style on stage. Someone bust through the wall. It's Justin Sun.
No, it's way cooler.
It is. Cool. Okay, we got one more question, and then I think we're going to go into QA mode and drink mode. So you kind of warmed us up here, but Zuko, maybe talk a little bit about the privacy sovereignty stuff. I think that's a good angle that maybe...
Yeah, there's a very simple thing which seems super obvious to me, and I don't know, I'd be interested to see if you agree or disagree, but... like Bitcoin came out clearly as a part of the cypherpunk movement. Now, I don't know who Satoshi was or if they, like, I think it's polite to use people's preferred pronouns and also their preferred names. So attempting to dox Satoshi really annoys me, and I never participate in it. But Satoshi, although I don't know anything about any more of their identity, they were clearly a part and parcel of the cypherpunk culture and community and the way they operated. Their goals were political and their means were technological, and that's the cypherpunks in a nutshell. And Satoshi, Hal Finney, and literally 100% of the people involved in the early days. I don't know if you know, but I'm the author of the first blog post ever posted on the internet about Bitcoin, and the initial bitcoin.org homepage that Satoshi put up linked to my homepage, back when we all had our own homepages. So I was like part of the community from the very beginning, and what really annoys me is revisionist history. I hate revisionist history. I'm like a obsessive accuracy maximalist. So what really pisses me off is when I hear people saying, oh, Bitcoin was always supposed to expose everyone's information to everyone else. That's the point. And I'm like, no, wait, I was there for the first 10 years straight, 100% of the people involved considered end-user privacy to be half of the main value add. Independence from central banks, right? Independence from central banks, and independence from all the power structures and policemen that want to control everyone else. That was a unified value proposition. Satoshi and Hal Finney and others literally talked about if they could use zero knowledge proofs to fix Bitcoin's privacy problem. And the reason they couldn't is it was like 6 years too early for the scientific inventions that we later implemented. Can I keep ranting? I forget where I was going with that. Okay, one more thing. Listen, I gotta tell you, you cannot have decentralization, censorship resistance, self-sovereignty, you cannot have ownership of your own stuff without privacy, all right? Like, if you're the Nazis and your job is to ban books, you don't have to intercept every truck coming in and inspect the trucks. All you have to do is say, our informants are watching you. If we find out you're reading a banned book, you're gonna regret it. If you don't have privacy, then the most powerful, least moral agent in the room can control everyone else. That's it. So privacy is 100% necessary for everything that we as a community value.
Next up, my chat with Emily Yang, AKA People Pleaser.
Yeah, so thanks for having me. I guess my background is that I was working in visual effects and feature animation for a few years after I graduated. And then how I got started in NFTs is basically, well, in 2017, I made my first investments in cryptocurrency just because it made sense to me. Like, I was reading about it and I found the blockchain to be super revolutionary. But it wasn't until 2020, when I was actually unemployed, that I saw sort of an opportunity to combine sort of like my skill set and this like world of crypto that I have like discovered. And NFTs weren't like that big then, so it was actually during, we know it's DeFi summer, which is when DeFi started having sort of like this huge surge, that I got my start in the industry. And I was just making these little like 30-second animations with different DeFi protocols. And then last year in March, I made the Uniswap V3 animation, and then it went viral, and I auctioned it off as an NFT, and then it sold for a lot of ETH. And PleaserDAO was formed specifically to buy that piece. And so what PleaserDAO was at the time was literally just people who were like in the industry and either like fans of my work or people that I have worked with before. They basically, a bunch of them came together, you know, like DeFi founders, just a lot of like really smart people, like pulled money together and bid on it as a collective, and they won. And I don't know, like life has exploded ever since.
It's kind of crazy. Cool. So you've been at the forefront of like all of this NFT explosion over the past year. It's a new concept for a lot of people. There's a lot of bad NFT takes out there. So I wanted to know, like, what's the funniest or maybe your favorite like bad NFT take? And like, how do you address that when someone comes to you like with an NFT take?
Well, you know, recently I saw like a bunch of comments online that were like, oh, NFTs are like Beanie Babies. You know, they're basically saying that it's like a bubble and that it's a fad. And I mean, so that's one of them. And I think, you know, sort of like my response to that is like, well, NFTs are not like Beanie Babies, because that would be like saying stuffed animals is a scam. You know, it's like stuffed animals is just stuffed animals, right? Like Beanie Babies is a specific brand or product. And so similar with NFTs, right now I feel like it's so new that people are getting it sort of like mixed up. But what NFTs are is really the technology behind, you know, putting this information on the blockchain and storing it as a token of ownership. And so, you know, you could say Bored Apes like can be like Beanie Babies in the future, because that's a specific product and brand. You know, not to FUD Bored Apes, like I have apes, so like I want it to go up forever. But I'm just saying, like, you know, you should think of it as the technology behind it and not that. And so, you know, it's like kind of like saying the internet or like electricity is going to go away or something, but it's not because it's the technology, right?
Totally. So I want to talk a little bit about the mashup of DAOs and NFTs. So in your mind, how do these two things go together? You know, I guess curious about how can NFT creators and artists themselves benefit from DAOs? And then also vice versa, how can individuals, you know, provide value for groups? And like, I don't know if you've seen any cool benefits for individuals joining DAOs in the NFT space. Like, what's your take there?
Well, I think, you know, a useful way to think about DAOs right now is that they're kind of basically like decentralized companies, right? And so really what's valuable about it is the fact that it is a collective of, you know, a bunch of different people's brain powers coming together. And, you know, I think the problems and issues that we're facing as like a society are getting more and more complex by the day. And, you know, it's definitely gotten to a point now where I think very, very few individuals can come and solve a problem. And so it needs the power of a collective to be basically come together, you know, and I always think of this as an analogy to like animation, right? Like a Pixar movie takes, you know, a whole studio of like a couple hundred people to make a really, really well-defined and good animation and final product. And so you can think of like a DAO as the same thing. It's the coordination of a lot of people with different skill sets and different areas of expertise and knowledge that come together and create ultimately a better product. And so that's how DAOs can, you know, benefit the individual, is that it's very, you know, you learn a lot and you can create better products working together. But for the other way around, it's a similar relationship where, you know, if you have something that you think you can contribute to a DAO, then you should join one. And also, I think what's so great about DAOs is like, it's not like traditional companies where I can only, you know, it's like so monogamous, like I can only work for one company. But you can actually be a contributor to multiple DAOs. And so, yeah.
Polydamorous.
Polydamorous.
Yeah, agree. Pleaser DAO, right? A lot of awesome things said about it. I like the phrase that Pleaser DAO is the people's Louvre of the 21st century. What do you think about that?
Well, that's high praise. I think, you know, really the concept behind Pleaser DAO is so simple. It's just exploring the idea of collective ownership. And so why it was such a big deal when it happened at the time is because, you know, when I was auctioning off an NFT, it wasn't news that an NFT could be selling for like, you know, $500,000. There were a bunch of NFTs that sold for more than what mine went for. But the reason why people paid attention to it is because before that, there were only sort of like individual collectors who were coming in and, you know, being the power players of the game, right? And that's very sort of akin to what we can see in traditional art today. It's just, you know, it's a game of like very, very wealthy individuals who can sort of like own certain pieces of art. And so when Pleaser DAO came in, it sort of, and because, you know, they used a Gnosis Safe, which is like an app, a decentralized app that allows people to like pull money together. And, you know, it's like kind of like a shared bank account on the blockchain. And so using this kind of technology, it's obviously like pretty like secure and, you know, you can trust it. And then so people started realizing, oh, it doesn't have, like, you know, you can do more if you come together instead of like one person. Like, you know, I'm sure none of us here probably can afford to spend like $500,000 on an NFT, but if we all put in a little money together, then we can. And that really was sort of like the aha moment for, you know, when people realized like what Pleaser DAO was doing was such a big deal.
Yeah. Another thing that Pleaser DAO pioneered is like getting behind some really awesome freedom and justice minded social causes, like the Stand With Asians movement. And I know right now you guys are working with the Free Ross DAO. So Yeah, talk to me a little bit about why the NFT movement is like positioned to do some of this stuff and social good, and you know, curious if there are like other social issues that you're curious about, like diving into with future stuff.
I think there's so many social issues that I care about. If I could, I wish that I could address like every single one of them, and I'm trying to slowly, you know, so. My first NFT, I created the Stand With Asians Community Fund. And so all of that, like, you know, $500,000 was donated and spread across like a bunch of different organizations, like 24 organizations actually, and each of them received a $25,000 grant. And, you know, recently they all filed back reports on saying like, you know, sort of like what was impacted. And I read, and apparently over 93,000 people's lives were impacted as a, you know, result of that donation. And then, you know, following that, I also partnered with like Fortune magazine. And then we created the Fortune Pleaser Fund, which specifically, you know, donates to causes that help like free journalism. And, you know, obviously being like Fortune is like, they are journalism. But I think, you know, luckily, like my first sale kind of like really inspired all the members of PleaserDAO to actually care about, you know, like making a positive social impact and, you know, like charitable causes. And so that's kind of just become one of the main pillars of what the DAO like seeks after, you know. So when they went after the Edward Snowden NFT, it's because it supports freedom of the press. And, you know, they bought the Tor Project, which is also a nonprofit. We obviously support Nadia's work, being that she supports, you know, so many great causes and social justice. And, you know, internet privacy is a huge thing that they care about as well. And it's really just, I think it's the culmination of a bunch of people who have benefited from cryptocurrency and want to sort of give back and also spread positivity around crypto. Because, you know, on the other side, there's a lot of people like saying it's a scam and, you know, all this kind of stuff. And yeah, like this technology is revolutionary, but it will sort of depend on the hands of the people or the intentions of the people behind it. So, you know, if there are bad actors in the space, well, that's just humanity and society in general. We can't prevent that. But what we can do is do our best to try to inspire more people to do better. And I think that's something that, you know, is really important to me and like my personal values and why I do what I do today. And hopefully PleaserDAO will follow as well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. Amazing to see all the good work that you guys are doing. And definitely, I think, inspiring others in the space. On a similar note, you know, in crypto, I think we see a big battle for like ideas, maybe more of a cultural battle. Good faith is something that a lot of new people in the space like are not always gifting us, right? It's cool that NFT sales can be used for all of these amazing like charity, social good causes, but there can be like a dark side to uncensorability as well. You know, like capital sometimes doesn't always care about the artists. You know, there's because it's so permissionless, you can have maybe like hate groups like use NFTs for, you know, a lot of ways. So I don't know. How do you think about like creating healthy norms in communities to ward against this sort of stuff?
I don't know. I always try to remain optimistic. And yeah, as I was previously saying, it's just like there's always going to be bad people on Earth. I think that's just like a matter of like life. But I think sort of, you know, at least through my story, it obviously seems to have resonated with a lot of people and has inspired people to like be better and, you know, look at crypto differently as well. You know, it's like, I think so much of our, like, the reporting around NFT sales and stuff revolves around how much, like, this NFT sold for and everything. But, you know, like, if there's any kind of, so I think that's sort of also how I got my start, too. They're just like, oh, my God, this NFT sold for $500,000. But now that I have this platform and voice, people are, and when I make, you know, sort of large sum donations, obviously, you know, with the, like, Asian organizations, like I could see the impact, but I don't always know if that has, you know, a direct impact or not. But I think what's most important is that these what I call Chad donations are causing people to actually pay attention to what I'm saying. And that's the most important part of this, is that I want you guys to be like, okay, we're actually paying attention to this girl because either something about money, but then what I'm saying is more important part is that, you know, if you or anybody else is like, first, obviously take care of yourself first. Don't go like, you know, start donating all your money if like you're gonna be starving as well. But if we're all sort of lucky enough to be in like a post-scarcity mindset or have access to give back, or, you know, if people make money so easily in like a crypto bull run, and so it doesn't hurt to share that with other people, especially people who aren't, you know, I think it takes a certain type of privilege to even have access to crypto, right? Like you need, first of all, like access to internet, be just living in a first world in general. And then so if we can use that and then help sort of amplify that to people in corners of the world who don't have access to that, that's something that is really important to me and makes everything that I'm doing worth it.
Yeah. So before we bring Nadia and Michael back on stage, I'm going to ask one last question. I'm going to actually steal it from them because I really liked it. A better world. So I hear this throughout a lot of the stuff that you're working on. I'm getting the sense that you also may have a vision for a better world and how the work that you do with NFTs and DAOs may weave into that. So yeah, what's your a better world?
I think, you know, like, I always talk about the state of flow, and you know, I'm somebody who's like fortunate enough now that I can be in a situation where, but I have gone through the path of like working for other people or like executing other people's visions. And that's always, you know, sort of like going to be a thing. But, you know, like thinking very optimistically, if things like universal basic income existed, then I think that will just, you know, without us having to worry about literally surviving or paying rent, it's just going to allow so much more brain space for us to be in the state of flow. And you, you know, the work that you produce, like in the state of flow, is like 1,000 times better than the work that you produce otherwise. And so I think the better world that I'm thinking of, super duper hypothetical and ideal, is that, you know, everybody is guaranteed sort of like some kind of basic income. And so they can use their free time to really like expand on things that, you know, everybody's creative, right? Like we talk about artists, like I'm an artist, but that doesn't mean only artists are creative. Like if you're a coder, you're a writer, you're a lawyer, like every human is ultimately creative, and you know, they produce the best work when they're in the creative state of flow. And so in each sort of vertical that everybody's working in, like just imagine the world like operating on like 10 times more creativity than they can, just because people are no longer having to worry about, you know, like paying their next meal or month's rent. So that's how I think about a better world.
I love it. Better world, more beautiful world. Cool. Well, thank you.
And last up, here's my conversation with Nadia Tokolno, founder of Pussy Riot.
Well, I guess I'm always questioning every possible status quo and every privilege that I see in front of me, every stereotype or trope that exists in cultural paradigms. That's my job as an artist. And I feel actually that artists are not some magic individuals given by gods to create. Do not believe in this genius romantic model of art. I believe that artists are workers, they're cultural workers, and their goal is to examine, right, this word, examine cultural norms and paradigms and see what can be done better and criticize what doesn't work. I really love making fun of things that don't actually work. I definitely do not do a lot of physical stuff, but my recent artwork, which was NFT, it was called Drink My Blood. It had a physical component to that. So it was an NFT. It was also my prison paper that was given to me upon my release from jail. And I spilled my own blood on top of this prison paper to express pain that I experienced while I was in jail. And also I made a vial with my own blood that I'm sending to my collectors, who is Pleaser DAO.
Yay for Pleaser DAO. And
blood for Blizzard.
Your sentencing papers were like,
which is super essential because I'm also in Blizzard now. Emily.
Wait. So your sentencing papers were like over 1,000 pages, right?
Sentencing papers? No, I think it was like 45 pages or something. So I made my previous artwork that Blizzard DAO also bought. It was Virgin Mary, Please Become a Feminist. And I drew Virgin Mary in the shape of vagina, which is like, you know, if you really take a look at like what happens in churches, it like for the most part, it already has the shape of vagina. So I guess just for making it obvious, I'm being accused of blasphemy and just have a lot of criminal cases on me in my home country.
Well, I'm glad you're in the U.S. now, for today.
Just today. I mean, I'm nomadic and also geographically anonymous. So, like, whenever people ask me where I'm based or where I'm at, like, if it doesn't affect the conversation, so, like, most of conversations, they can be held without mentioning where the person is, right?
Yeah, well, I think that's increasingly true. So you started talking about some of your NFT projects. I know you also had a project that I think raised quite a bit of ETH for domestic abuse victims. Is there anything you want to say about just other NFT or DAO or cryptocurrency project that you've been involved with over the past couple of years? Because I know you've, even just for like payments, because you guys would have your bank accounts frozen, crypto is really useful.
That's right. That's how we started to explore crypto first, besides drugs. Well, we're building right now something that's called Pussyverse, which is an organization of, that actually has a lot of prominent individuals, including People Pleaser and people like Jen Stark and Blake Catherine and Ix Schultz and Betty from Deadfellas, Lirona, and like pretty much every strong female artist you can name, they're all came together in this organization to make sure that female and LGBTQ plus created artworks are not undervalued, because that's the case right now and it's lame. Yeah, we want to be more, we want to be represented better. And also we're collaborating with a bunch of other DAOs, like Her Story DAO, Blizzard DAO, Flamingo DAO. Tribute helps us to set up the whole thing. So it's going to be really, I guess, influential. I hope so. Because when you just put a lot of whales and influential artists in the room, it really can define what the future of NFTs will look like. And the future of NFTs is going to be female.
Woo! with NFTs or DAOs or crypto in general, are there like new kinds of possibilities that you feel like are opened up? Like, it seems like artistically, financially, and maybe like organizationally, there's some new things, but what has you most excited?
I'm excited about crypto because it provides you tools to build sustainable and scalable anarchy. That's how I define it. So meaning that you don't have to rely on centralized systems in order to redistribute goods, which is a big, big thing for me. And as someone who actually kind of from Soviet Union, I'm 1989, so I witnessed a lot of problems that Soviet Union and centralized economy created. I'm in solidarity with a lot of goals of redistribution and making people feel more comfortable in society and feeling supported, feeling like they have something to rely on. So I'm definitely in tune with that, but also at the same time, I'd always have problems with centralized models to make it work because I saw it didn't work. So I guess that's why I'm really excited about DAOs and blockchain in general as a tool for that. Definitely fundraising is a big thing. And yeah, you mentioned we raised quite a bit of money for this organization that helps women who suffered from domestic violence in one of the regions of Russia that I can't even name because it's too dangerous. It's somewhere around Chechnya, and you could probably heard about Chechnya from this documentary, Welcome to Chechnya, done by HBO. It's a place where people are being abused for just being different. I feel like this is with using blockchain, it helps you to reach really global community. A and B, I mean, like this ecosystem definitely has a lot of money and also a lot of people who really honestly, genuinely want to build better future, which is the best combination for activism. And I really believe that over the next few years, we're going to be seeing more people who are showing off their wealth with helping other people rather than going to strip clubs and like buying really expensive tables, which is, I mean, I don't know. Like I love strip clubs. I would rather spend $100,000 on charity than on a bottle of expensive vodka. Yeah, I think just methods of showing off should be a little bit different.
Cool. Well, you might have just touched on some of them, but you've talked about part of the reason you wanted to get involved in crypto was to help kind of drive its evolution. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, what are some things that you'd like to change? I mean, one is there are a lot of people that look like me.
You look just fine. I like Trippy's style a little bit more, but... no, I mean, I know what you're talking about. So, historically, unfortunately, women were told that we are not technical, that we are supposed to go study philosophy and sociology. I was a good girl. I followed what I was told and went to study philosophy. But I was quite tech-oriented when I was really a little girl. And so I just believe that we should... somehow balance it out because so right now big bags of ETH are being held mostly by white males, and I think it's just because women felt that they're not welcome to that party. Not all of them, obviously, but generally statistics is pretty sad for girls. But I think it's changing right now, and like we see a rise of female-led NFTs project. And I mean, and we are happy as Pussyverse to be part of it, and we are going to be doing a lot of IRL events to just make sure that we're creating safe and really attractive space for female and LGBTQ plus folks. Because like right now, when I'm inviting them to crypto events, they're often bored, to be honest. Or worse, they're being harassed. And I was verbally, sexually harassed by a person who was supposed to be my collector. I'm not naming him, but that was lame. Didn't like it. And that was one of the reasons why I decided to create this Pussyverse safe space for women.
Thank you. All right, so I think we have time for one more question. Then we'll hop off. Then... Emily from PleaserDAO is going to jump on. But I have one last question. So one thing I've heard you talk about is a better planet. I really like this expression. What does a better planet look like to you? And what can the artists, technologists, community, I don't know, what can the people in this room kind of best do to help facilitate that?
It's a long, long answer. But I think it's like important to acknowledge when we talk about utopias that there should not be just one utopia, because it's again like falling back into this USSR model when I know what to do for everyone else. That's not ideal. But my utopia is going to be a planet where, I mean, we have better global coordination, because I feel like we do have a lot of issues like climate change or global inequality that will inevitably cause conflicts and wars, and it's not going to feel nice or cute. It's not going to be comfortable. So we better try to decide to solve it a little bit earlier before it actually develops into real conflict. So I think we should, and you know, organizations like the UN, they don't really work anymore, and they don't really have any respect or authority. So that's number one. And I really believe, I don't have an answer how it's going to work, but I really believe that all of us in this room, people who are interested in blockchain models of governance, we can actually combine this very, very local approach where we decide like how our communities look like, and like, you know, how our cities look like, what kind of ads do we see, any ads, and stuff like that. But with like, at the same time, really global approach. So I guess greener planet with better connection between different parts of the planet. And definitely would love to see a distribution of public goods done better in a lot of places, including United States of America. Countries like Russia, they're being looked down at often, but actually if you walk around Moscow, even with all the corruption, it's like pretty incredible. You feel yourself rich and important if you just like walk around Moscow, and you don't have to own anything just because public spaces are really beautiful.
The subway?
Subway looks like a palace. The question, how it was built, because it was built by slave labor prisoners. And that's not what we want.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Everyone, let's thank Nadia. And we'll be back on stage in a few minutes.
Thank you.